南无塔萨玛卡瓦托阿拉哈托萨玛萨布塔萨南无塔萨玛卡瓦托阿拉哈托萨玛萨布塔萨南无塔萨玛卡瓦托阿拉哈托萨玛萨布塔萨布唐塔芒桑康那玛萨弥。Good evening to everyone. Sorry about the delayed start. I was waiting for everyone to show up in the temple. It seems to have been some crossed wires along the way, but anyway, here we are. So this year, there was a suggestion that we do readings from this book that was published last year called Catastrophe Apostrophe, The Buddha's Teaching on Dependent Origination Cessation. And so this is put together by myself, or published by myself last year, so with a caveat of shameless self-promotion. I didn't suggest it to be read, but somebody else did, but I'm happy to read it out, because as I've been saying, I feel that the teachings on dependent origination are very much the core of the Dhamma teachings, and Lumpo Samato in past years would spend the whole winter retreat just giving teachings about dependent origination, and so I felt it was a valuable topic to visit, both for everyone's well-being, also because I was very familiar with the material. Often, even when you're reading your own book, sometimes you find things that are in there that you didn't realize you put in there. Oh, did I write that? So maybe I'll discover a few things I put in here that I forgot about, but I'm fairly familiar with most of it, so hopefully it'll be a good basis for exploration and informing our practice. So I'll read the preface first of all, just to get things underway. Can everyone hear me okay? Over the last few years, I have led residential retreats specifically on the theme of dependent origination on at least five occasions, at Amravati in the UK, in Merim, Thailand, and with Le Refuge at Monastère de Ségriès in the south of France. Various aspects of this rich, essential theme of Buddhist teaching have been focused upon in these different situations according to the interests and needs of the various communities. The little booklet entitled Just One More, Appreciative Joy, Jealousy, Selfish Desire, and the Buddha's Teaching on the Cycles of Addiction, which is one of the four books on the Brahma Viharas that I did, that was based on material from one of these events, a 10-day retreat at Amravati in July of 2013. Most of the material gathered in this present book was presented at a retreat in Provence in April 2018, and the remainder is from the Merim retreats of 2016, 17, and 18. The subject of dependent origination is intrinsically rich and varied, subtle, and multidimensional, as the Buddha expressed in this notable exchange with his disciple and attendant, Venerable Ananda. So this is from the Mahanidana Sutta in the Digha Nikaya, Long Discourses, the great discourse on causation in the Digha Nikaya. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living among the Kurus near a town of theirs named Kamasadhamma. Their Venerable Ananda approached the Blessed One, and on arrival, having bowed down to the Blessed One, sat to one side. As he was sitting there, he said to the Blessed One, "It is wonderful, Venerable Sir, it's marvelous, how profound this dependent origination is, and how profound its appearance, and yet, to me, it appears as clear can be." "Do not say that, Ananda, do not say that. This dependent origination is profound, and it appears profound. It is through not understanding and not penetrating this Dhamma that this generation has become like a tangled ball of string, matted like a bird's nest, tangled like coarse grass, and is unable to pass beyond the cycles of rebirth, beyond the plains of deprivation, woe, and bad destinations." So Venerable Ananda, as usual, is being corrected by the Buddha when he gets a little bit enthusiastic. So the Buddha frequently says, "Not so, Ananda. Do not say that, Ananda." but that sense of conceptual understanding of this process is one thing, but the true complete penetration of it is another. And I think I mentioned the other day in a Dhamma talk how the discourse on the elephant's footprint, in the middle length discourses, Sutta number 28, the Buddha is quoted as saying, one who sees dependent origination sees the Dhamma. One who sees the Dhamma sees dependent origination. So that's in the greater discourse on the elephant's footprint. So it's kind of interesting in that sutta. Then the Buddha says, you know, as it has been said, one who sees dependent origination sees the Dhamma. One who sees the Dhamma sees dependent origination. But Bhikkhu Bodhi's note on that is that actually you can't find that anywhere else in the Pali Canon. The only place where you find it. And so the Buddha's saying, you know, as it has been said, but there's no other place that's been recorded as, at least in the Pali Canon as it's come down to us. There have already been many erudite and wise explorations of the subject published in English, such as Dependent Origination, The Buddha's Law of Conditionality by Venerable P.A. Paiuto, and later on in the retreat, hopefully, if we get through this in time, I'll pick that up and we'll go through some of Venerable Paiuto's teachings there. And I personally feel that's the best book in English on dependent origination. Very accessible, very thorough, and very multifaceted and well translated. Also, there's the collection of 5 chapters on the theme in Ajahn Sumedho's book, The Way It Is. So there's Dhamma talks that he gave at the winter retreats here at Amravati. So there's 5 chapters altogether in The Way It Is, all on dependent origination by Lumpur Sumedho. And then Ajahn Buddhadasa's book, Under the Bodhi Tree, The Buddha's Original Vision of Dependent Co-arising, as well as many others. The intention of this present volume, whilst acknowledging the already great storehouse of perspectives available, is to focus upon practical means of understanding and applying the principles of dependent origination in order to support the freeing of the heart from addictive and destructive cycles of attitude and behavior. In particular, the emphasis will be on the exit points from this wheel of becoming, the bhava chakra, this cyclical process where the mind feels itself to be imprisoned in a habitual round of promise, gratification, and disappointment. Any questions or clarification needed? These readings are for you. They're not just for me to sit up here and spout. So they're for all of you. So if there's anything that you'd like to ask about or anything that comes to mind, be most welcome to speak. Okay. The choice of title for the book was influenced by the fact of presenting the material at a retreat center in France, and the presence in the local mythology of Asterix and Obelix for the title Catastrophe Apostrophe. For many people, I know English is not the first language of most people here, but even for people for whom English is your first language, that would probably be an odd combination of words. But that's deliberate, of course. So in French, Asterix and Obélisque in French. In some respects, the two are perfectly matched as friends and companions in many adventures. So I presume people are familiar with Asterix and Obelix, the cartoon books by Goscinny and Underzo. No? No? So they are many, many stories of these two characters. They are dwellers of a little French village in Gaul, France, in the time of the Romans, and they have a magic potion that they brew up that gives them extra strength, so that they can continually confound the Romans. So always there's like one part of France is unconquered by the Romans. It says Gaul was divided into 3 parts. No, actually it was 4, and the 4th is the little village where Asterix and Obelix live, without going into too much detail. Anyway, so that's a very popular story in France. And it struck me how many years ago these two words, catastrophe, meaning like a disaster or a big problem or some kind of crisis, and apostrophe, which means a little punctuation mark that indicates where some letters are missing in a word or an abbreviation, that they are referring to completely different things, but they are quite a close match, because in Greek the both words come from the Greek, and that kata and apo are a pair, like cathode and anode, or in Christian philosophy, cataphatic and apophatic ways of relating to knowledge. So the cataphatic is to say yes to, is like talking about what the nature of ultimate reality, the nature of God, and apophatic is talking about what God is not. So that kata and apo are a pair, but then also catastrophe and apostrophe would seem to be completely different. And then anyway, not to go into too much detail, but Asterix is a very kind of tiny little guy, but when he drinks the potion, then he becomes super strong and is very clever and cunning. And his friend Obelix is very large, and he fell into a vat of the magic potion when he was a baby, so he became permanently strong. He didn't have to drink any more potion, and he's not very bright, but he's a good guy. So, and then I was in, and I had in the back of my mind, it's strange how apostrophe and catastrophe are similar words, but they have opposite meanings. And then I'd been asked to give a 10-day retreat on the theme of dependent origination in France. And somehow or other, while I was on that retreat, it sort of crossed my mind that, and I'm not quite sure what triggered it. Oh, well, Asterix and Obelix is kind of like catastrophe and apostrophe. And then as I was talking about dependent origination through the whole 10 days of the retreat, I realized, well, actually, the arising part of the cycle, how dukkha, how suffering gets conditioned, that's the catastrophe. And then the paticca nirodha, the cessation part of the cycle, what's called the patiloma. Anuloma is the arising part, or patiloma is the where dukkha nirodha, the cessation of dukkha. That, just like an apostrophe, is a thing that represents a nothing. It represents an absence. It marks an absence. I thought, well, nirodha also is a word that marks an absence of something. So as that retreat progressed, I thought, well, that's not a bad way of representing these teachings on dependent arising, dependent cessation. And so then when I was asked to put the book together, the people in France said, "Oh, can we put this together as a book, and we'll translate it into French?" And I thought, okay, well, maybe I can use that pair of terms as a title. So that's where it came from. Not that you needed to know that, but in case you were wondering, like, catastrophe, apostrophe, what the heck's that about? So, in some respects, the two are perfectly matched, as friends and companions in many adventures. But in others, there's a radical contrast between them. Their names share a rhyming ending, yet in meaning they are utterly different. An asterisk being a small star-shaped punctuation mark, while an obelisk is a tall, pointed, monumental stone column, similar to the menhirs regularly carried around by the eponymous hero. So Obelix used to make big stone slabs of stone and carry them around. He was a menhir maker and deliverer, like Stonehenge, the kind of stones of Stonehenge he used to be seen carrying those around. Accordingly, catastrophe and apostrophe might appear to have nothing to do with each other, but in other ways they can be seen as a perfectly matched pair. And I talk more about that as the book progresses. A final note on word use is that technically the process which is the theme of this book should be described as dependent origination and dependent cessation. The cessation part being particularly significant as it's referring to the ending of dukkha, dissatisfaction, suffering, which is the main purpose of the teaching in the first place. For the sake of brevity and convenience, I will mostly use the term dependent origination as a shorthand for the fuller expression dependent origination and dependent cessation. So, dear reader and dear listeners, please bear that in mind as you make your way through these pages, or as we make our way through the pages together. So the verses that we chant in Pali, what's called the loma is hair, like the hair on the skin, and anuloma is with the grain of the hair, And patiloma is against the grain of the hair. So kesa loma nakadanta tacho, hair of the head, hair of the body. So loma is just that hair, or animal fur. So anuloma is the arising part, and then patiloma is the cessation part. So when we do the funeral chanting, we often recite this sequence of dependent origination, avicca paccaya sankara, sankara paccaya vijnana, and so on. And then the cessation part, the patiloma, is avijaya taveva asesa viraga niroda, sankara niroto, sankara nirota, and so on. So those of you who've done retreats with Goenkaji will also be very familiar with these verses. I think he recites these dependent origination verses very regularly. Also, I refer to specific conditionality, ida pachayata, quite often, and the Pali that is the source of this, that essential teaching on specific conditionality. I've also got here at the front of the book, so you can refer to that as well. And that ida pachayata is characterized by the teaching that when this exists, that comes to be. With the arising of this, that arises. When this does not exist, that does not come to be. With the cessation of this, that ceases. And the Pali is iti imasming sati idam hoti, imas upada idam upajati, imasming asati idam nahoti, imasa nirota idam nirujati. So any questions, comments, thoughts? So the last piece I'd like to kind of cover by way of introduction is the epigraph, which is the little quotation that you put at the front of a book. I use the definition of catastrophe from the Oxford English Dictionary. Comes from the Greek kata and strophein. So kata means down, and strophein means to turn. So it literally means to overturn, or something to be turned upside down. And the OED definition is a final event, a conclusion generally unhappy, a disastrous end, finish up, conclusion, upshot, overthrow, ruin, calamitous fate. And then with respect to apostrophe, I used a little passage from a very insightful, wonderful play. So it's actually talking about a comma rather than apostrophe, but I use poetic license there. So this is from a play called Wit, written by a woman called Margaret Edson, who was a primary school teacher. It's the only thing she ever published. She won a Pulitzer Prize for this play. And it's about an English professor who's dying of cancer. And in this dialogue, they are talking about a poem of John Donne, which I've got here, which I can read out for you. And it's a dialogue between this professor who's got terminal cancer and her old university teacher. And it's a memory of a dialogue they had when she was a young student. And they are talking about this poem of John Donne's. And the last line of the poem is, and this is the elder professor is speaking. It reads, "And death shall be no more, comma, death thou shalt die." As she recites this line, she makes a little gesture of the comma. "Nothing but a breath, a comma, separates life from life everlasting." It's very simple, really. With the original punctuation restored, death is no longer something to act out on the stage. It's a comma, a pause. What she's talking about is in the original printing of this John Donne poem, there was just a comma after "death shall be no more," comma. In later editions, it was a semicolon, which is a much harder stop. And funnily enough, in this edition, which is an Oxford Book of English Verse, it's actually a colon, which is an even harder stop. But what she's saying is that way of understanding death, and then it becomes very pertinent to this person's life, and it becomes the title of the whole play. It's a comma, a pause. This way, the uncompromising way, one learns something from the poem, wouldn't you say? Death, life, soul, God, past, present. Not insuperable barriers, not semicolons, just a comma. Then Vivian, the woman who's got cancer, is a young student, she says, life, death, I see. It's a metaphysical conceit, it's wit. I'll go back to the library and rewrite the paper. And her professor says, it's not wit, Miss Baring, it's truth. The paper's not the point. It isn't? Vivian, you're a bright young woman. Use your intelligence. Don't go back to the library. Go out. Enjoy yourself with your friends. So I felt that was it was a play I was familiar with, and I felt that in the apostrophe being just a little mark that indicates an absence was very much in the same spirit that she's talking about here. That that death that is so sort of dramatized and made much of in John Donne's original vision, in the original the expression of the poet, was just, it wasn't a big kind of dramatic ending. It was just a comma, just the lightest of pauses, just a breath. Not insuperable barriers, not semicolons, just a comma. And so I felt that represented in quite a good way that sense of Niroda, Dukkha Niroda, that which is about the ending of death and changing the attitude towards death. It's a mark, it's a way of indicating a change of attitude. It's just a subtle way of representing a shift of view. As in our ordinary everyday world, we think of death as something dramatic and shocking and painful. But the more that we develop insight into the whole process of perception and how the mind makes the world so solid and real, as that as the quality of vicha or awareness is strengthened, then that way of reifying, of making the world solid and real, and the mind chasing after its dislikes and its fears and its desires, then that the ending of something is just a comma, just an apostrophe, just a breath. And so we use the word Niroda. It's a word, but it's a word that indicates something has ended. It's like a something that represents a nothing, an ending. So just to share with you the John Donne poem. Death, be not proud, though some have called thee mighty and dreadful, for thou art not so. For those whom thou think'st thou dost overthrow, die not, poor death, nor yet canst thou kill me. From rest and sleep, which but thy picture be, much pleasure, then from thee much more must flow, and soonest our best men with thee do go, rest of their bones and souls' delivery. Thou art slave to fate, chance, kings, and desperate men, and dost poison war and sickness dwell, and dost with poison war and sickness dwell, and poppy or charms can make us sleep as well, and better than thy stroke. Why swell'st thou then? One short sleep past, we wake eternally, and death shall be no more. Death, thou shalt die. I realize English is not the first language of most people here, and that's the old-fashioned English. He wrote that in 1609, so 400 years ago, but just to let you know where that came from. Okay, so we can go into the book proper now. The first chapter is called Before We Begin. The theme for this book is dependent origination. We can call this the wheel of birth and death, or the wheel of becoming in classical language, or cycles of addiction in modern language. My intention is not for this to be an academic presentation. I'll try to describe and explain these teachings so that they'll be of immediate benefit to all of our lives, specifically addressing methods whereby the wheel can be let go of, or even broken. The subject can be very complicated, but I will endeavour to keep it practical and direct. Those of you who have read about the Buddha's teachings on dependent origination may have thought that the subject was Byzantine, very complicated and hard to understand, and impenetrable. The 12 links, or 12 sections, of dependent origination can seem confusing or strange. That's a common experience. But at the heart of the teaching is a very simple principle that I will aim to focus on. Hopefully, during the course of this book, we'll be able to explore and investigate this teaching and see how the different pieces fit together, and how they explain experiences that we're all familiar with. A theoretical map, iddhapaccayata. It is significant that the Buddha was engaged in the deep exploration and analysis of specific conditionality and dependent origination immediately after his enlightenment. And so then there's a quote from the suttas from the, this is from the Mahavagga, the beginning of the book of the, one of the books of the discipline, and also in the Udana. Thus I heard, on one occasion when the Blessed One was newly enlightened, he was living at Uruvela by the banks of the river Niranjara, at the root of the Bodhi tree, the tree of enlightenment. Then the Blessed One sat at the root of the Bodhi tree for 7 days in one session, feeling the bliss of deliverance. At the end of the 7 days, he emerged from that concentration, and in the first watch of the night, his mind was occupied with dependent arising in forward order thus. That comes to be when there is this. That arises with the arising of this. That is to say, it is with ignorance as condition that formations come to be, with formation as condition consciousness, with consciousness as condition name and form, with name and form as condition the sixfold base, that's the six senses, i.e. nose, tongue, body, mind. With the sixfold base as condition contact, with contact as condition feeling, with feeling as condition craving, with craving as condition clinging, with clinging as condition being, with being as condition birth, with birth as condition aging and death come to be, and also sorrow and lamentation, pain, grief and despair. That is how there is an origin to this whole aggregate mass of suffering. Knowing the meaning of this, the Blessed One uttered this exclamation. When things are fully manifest to the ardent meditating Brahman, his doubts all vanish, for he knows that each thing has to have its cause. In the second watch of the night, his mind was occupied with dependent arising in reverse order, thus. So the forward order is the anuloma, and the what he calls the, this is Venerable Nyanamoli's translation, what he calls the reverse order is the patiloma. That does not come to be when there is not this. That ceases with the cessation of this. That is to say, with the cessation of ignorance, there is the cessation of formations. With the cessation of formations, the cessation of consciousness. And name and form, the sixfold base, contact, feeling, craving, clinging, being, birth, aging, and death cease. And also sorrow and lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. That is how there is a cessation to this whole aggregate mass of suffering. Knowing the meaning of this, the Blessed One uttered this exclamation. When things are fully manifest to the ardent meditating Brahman, his doubts all end, for he perceives how the conditions come to end. In the third watch of the night, his mind was occupied with dependent arising in forward and reverse order thus. That comes to be when there is this, that arises with the arising of this. That does not come to be when there is not this, that ceases with the cessation of this. That is to say, it's with ignorance as condition that formations come to be, with formations as condition consciousness, so on and so forth. With birth as condition, aging and death come to be, and also sorrow and lamentation, pain, grief and despair. That is how there is an origin to this whole aggregate mass of suffering. With the cessation of ignorance, there is a cessation of formations. With the cessation of formations, cessation of consciousness, and so on. To the cessation of birth, aging and death cease. And also sorrow and lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. That is how there is a cessation to this whole aggregate mass of suffering. Knowing the meaning of this, the Blessed One then uttered this exclamation. When things are fully manifest to the ardent meditating Brahman, there, like the sun who lights the sky, he stands repelling Mara's hosts. The very core, the source code of the process of dependent origination is the law of specific conditionality, iddha-pachayata in Pali, as is described in the quotation above. The Pali word idda means in this or here. Pachaya means conditioned or affected by. The suffix ta means the quality of or ness. Iddha-pachayata thus means the quality of having its foundation in this, being causally connected like this, being by way of cause, or conditioned by thisness. In essence, it's the process whereby one thing affects another. In the above passage from the scriptures, it can be summarized as, when this exists, that comes to be. With the arising of this, that arises. When this does not exist, that does not come to be. With the cessation of this, that ceases. Questions, thoughts? Yes.
Volitional formations come into being, it means that they have a cause. So, like some cause previously was created, and then the mind acts upon it. So, then it creates dukkha, like it's.
It leads to dukkha,
yes. It leads to dukkha, yes. So, it's some kind of disharmonious, not enlightened kind of action, not the right action. Mm-hmm. And then, the right action that is not based on traditional formation would be something that is not connected by the cause of the previous karma and impressions. So it would be immediate, like
it would be what?
Immediate. Mm-hmm. Like there will be previous impressions acting. It would be something that comes without distance from present moment, right? So it would be, wouldn't be the harmony with it.
Well, yeah, it's the there is another teaching that I'll go refer to later on, which covers the same area of experiencing, but in a slightly from a slightly different angle, and it's how the mind relates to experience and feeling, like sense perception and feeling, when there is concentration, mindfulness, and wisdom, and so that then there's still seeing and hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, because of the you know the body and the senses operating, then. If there is sufficient concentration, mindfulness, and wisdom, samadhi, sati, and panya, then rather than the experience of feeling or perceiving going towards dukkha, there's still a causal process. It's still one thing affecting another. But because there is that, say, the informing quality of mindfulness and wisdom, then that the flow of experience doesn't lead towards dukkha, rather it leads towards liberation and peacefulness. So it's still a causal process, but it's because of the presence of essentially mindfulness and wisdom, awareness, then that process of experiencing, it doesn't lead to dukkha, it leads to a quality of, it leads to nibbana, essentially.
So it's not a personal qualities that the manifest in action, but it's more like mindfulness and wisdom, which is impersonal.
Yeah, it's not personal insofar as the more that the quality of mindfulness and wisdom is established, then the less there is the habits of self view and identification that's affecting the whole system, and so that when there is feeling, then the Vedana, then rather than that feeling leading conditioning tanha, which it does in the standard sort of dependent origination pattern, so Vedana Pachaya Tanha. So in if there's a basis of mindfulness and wisdom, then that feeling say, conditions or supports, qualities of concentration and more mindfulness, more wisdom, and that leads to liberation and to nibbana. And so that in the second Patiloma, so avijaya toeva asesa viraga nirodha, when there's, because what it means is that when there is no ignorance, when there is vicha rather than avicha, when there is awareness rather than ignorance, then that sankhara doesn't arise. That kind of and that doesn't mean that we stop sort of perceiving, or that the senses shut down, or that the feelings come to an end, but rather the mind doesn't make those solid. It doesn't make them me and mine. It doesn't hold them in that distorted way. It knows, oh, this is a feeling. This is what's being experienced. It doesn't say, I am happy, or I'm unhappy, I'm hot, I'm cold. It's not personalizing or making them falsely, giving them a false solidity, but rather it's seeing them as they are. It's a feeling. This is a feeling of liking. This is a feeling of disliking. This is a feeling of comfort. This is a feeling of discomfort. And so then that that vedana, then it helps to support the quality of concentration, which supports mindfulness, which supports wisdom, and that supports deliverance and the realization of the deathless and peacefulness, nibbana.
It means that mind kind of have a sleep, so it doesn't really understand the danger of this kind of perception.
Exactly.
And basically, the one who constantly has this mindfulness means that he completely knows the consequences of
it. Exactly, yeah. So that when there's a lack of mindfulness, then a comfortable feeling, then say, oh, this is good. You know, I'm happy, and this is a good thing, and this is my experience, and it gives it a false solidity, and makes it personal. Yeah. I've got what I want. I'm happy. This is good, and takes those to be absolutely real qualities. And similarly, if I'm uncomfortable or things are painful and difficult, this is what I don't want. This is bad. This is wrong, and I don't want to feel this way. So it personalizes it, makes it solid. And so the more mindfulness and wisdom there is, the more that quality of awareness is sustained, then it's more and more quickly and completely the mind knows it, the nature of feeling, and doesn't get drawn into it. So as with many of the aspects of the say, escape from the cycles of the dependent origination, the wheel of becoming, there is often pointed to that the weakest link is between feeling and craving. And so a lot of the forest tradition practice focus and the teachings of many of the great meditation masters focus upon feeling and seeing how feeling conditions craving, and learning to be mindful of feeling, aware of feeling and perception, so that then those habits of chasing after what we like and running away from or contending against what we dislike, those habits are understood and can be let go of. And so there's the realm of perception and feeling is the mind is relating to it with a quality of responsivity, responding to it rather than reacting. Okay, I'll just read a little bit more. The 12 links of the classical recension of dependent origination are cast in the form of one thing conditioning the next. They affect each other, but the exact way in which each of the 12 links affects the others can vary. One of the most important distinctions in that way of affecting or conditioning is that they can be either sequentially in time or synchronically, i.e. concurrently, simultaneously. So, again, these are long English words, not easy to understand. Also, Ajahn Tanisro has written a lot about this, and it's very helpful, his description of this same verse about conditionality. he analyzes it quite thoroughly in his teachings. So an example of sequential conditionality would be that of an acorn. So an acorn, like a seed from an oak tree, is called an acorn. Having been planted, it conditions, later in time, the arising of an oak tree. If there was no acorn, it would be impossible for an oak tree to arise. So that the acorn, being planted in the ground, then is a condition that supports the arising of an oak tree. If there's no acorn, you can't get an oak tree. An example of synchronic conditionality would be when sunlight shines through the window onto my desk. So when I was writing this. If I hold my hand above the desk, the shadow of my hand forms on the surface. There is a conditional relationship between the shadow of my hand and the light on the desk, which is completely synchronic. The sunlight pervades the area that the shadow leaves, and the shadow pervades the area that the sunlight leaves. They affect each other simultaneously. So, both of those are fairly rough examples, but it gives you a bit of an idea what that means. So synchronically means literally at the same time, and then sequentially means one thing after another. Without going into too much detail, suffice it to say that there are many different ways that such affecting, quote-unquote, can take place. Classically, there are said to be 24 modes of such conditioning, but to list them all would probably cause more confusion than clarity. For those who are interested, they are gathered in the book of the Abhidhamma called Conditional Relations, the Patana. So it's all there in the books if you want to look it up. It's helpful simply to understand that with respect to the connections between the 12 links, dependent origination, dependent cessation, that it's not a matter of a uniform linear chain of A directly causes B, B directly causes C, C directly causes D, etc. Rather, it should be understood that the pachaya, quote-unquote, aspect means A affects B in some way, B affects C in some way, and so forth. With these conditional relations being sometimes synchronic at the same time, sometimes sequential, one thing after another, sometimes partial, so they have a small effect or a partial effect, sometimes conascent, like arising at the same time, born together, in one of those 24 modes. Thus, dependent origination is not a simple linear mechanistic process, but rather one that is complex, nuanced, non-linear, and responsive. And again, in the Abhidhamma, the chanting we do for funerals, along with the Avicca Paccaya Sankara, one of the chants that we do is the Hetu Paccayo Aramana Paccayo, that one, that Hetu Paccayo chant, that's the 24 conditional relations. So some of you might be more familiar with those than you realize. But when you read the English translations of some of those Pali words, it can be extremely unclear exactly what they're about. So there are explanations and good commentaries available on Abhidhamma if you do want to follow those up. I think in particular Bhikkhu Bodhi's explanations are quite helpful. So, any questions? Yes, Thomas.
Clarify, as from the previous portion of text, with a reference to either meditating on Brahman or meditating in Brahman, my question is, as Brahman, as the term, does that refer to the same concept or the same reality as the Hindu tradition knows the absolute reality to be as Brahman? Is that the same word?
No, it's the Buddha is using the term to refer to a meditator. So, like in the Dhammapada, there's the Brahmanavaga, the chapter on the Brahman, and it's a commentary on the caste system. And so he's saying a true Brahman is a meditator, a spiritual practitioner. And so throughout that in particular that section of the Dhammapada, those verses talk about a true meditator, a true spiritual seeker. This is how they operate, and it's independent of one's birth or ancestry. So in that passage about he was the sort of spontaneous verses that arose in his mind after that week of sitting under the Bodhi tree. When things are fully manifest to the ardent meditating Brahman, there, like the sun who lights the sky, he stands repelling Mara's hosts. So it's just like the ardent meditating yogi or spiritual practitioner.
So once it affects the other, then my understanding of affects is like, it's already there. The other thing is already there, right?
Well, yeah, there isn't really a perfect English word. And I tried to sort of spell it out there, that sometimes there are things that arise together, like conascent means being born at the same time. And so that it's, one thing is related to another, or is... being causally connected like this, so that the definitions of avidapachayata, it doesn't mean that both thing, that one thing is there first and the other one comes along after. They can be that they both come into being together, like the shadow appears when the sun comes out. Yeah. And that they're related together and they affect each other, but they are. And I try to give that example about sunlight and shadow. Of course, it does take some time for the light to pass by your hand and reach the desk, but I thought that was poetic license. Again, I could get away with saying it's at the same time. There's a relatedness between the two parts, and also there's quite a number of different descriptions of dependent origination. There's about 9 varieties that you get throughout the Pali Canon, the different ways that the different parts affect each other is sometimes it takes quite a bit of reflecting and getting a sense of how the words work to get a real feeling for what's being said. So, for example, in the Mahanidana Sutta, the discourse in the Digha Nikaya where the Buddha was talking to Ananda, in that it starts off with, well, it goes back from dukkha and through birth, and then follows the cycle all the way back to my nama rupa conditions consciousness. And it's because of consciousness that nama and nama rupa arise, and then it says because of nama rupa consciousness arises, that the two kind of goes back that far, and the two lean upon each other, nama rupa and vijnana, they lean upon each other, or they affect each other. So logically, it's like, well, how can this is the largest discourse about dependent origination, and that particular pattern is quite, not totally unique, but somewhat unique. Oh, so consciousness conditions mentality, materiality, and mentality, materiality conditions consciousness. And then it says in the sutta, it turns back upon itself. So it's one of the reasons why it can be, the whole subject can be quite confusing, because it can seem, well, hang on a minute, that doesn't match what it said in the other sutta. So there's a number of places where things don't quite match up. So part of the purpose of doing a book about dependent origination was to try and help people get a feeling for what the different terms refer to, and getting a direct sense of how to work with the whole gestalt, as it were. So I'll leave it there. Today I have a meeting I have to be part of at 7:00, so I have to draw things in another world. So draw things to a close there for today.
Sadhu.